Today in Studio 360, take that tired old buddy cop movie formula and flip it on its head. What you end up with is this.
I am a federal agent.
What are those?
They're banks. They just hold everything together.
Why? What's going to come popping out?
I'll talk with the team behind the funny new lady cop action comedy, The Heat.
Women are half the population of the world. And yet, of studio releases, we are the only movie this summer to star women.
We pack up and head to Hawaii with the humorous Jack Handy.
There was a spring in my step, so much so that people told me to stop doing it.
An exclusive new episode from Handy's first novel, The Stench of Honolulu. Plus, the art star Eric Fischel is all about the viewers completing his paintings for him.
They look at the woman and they decide, is that the mother, a babysitter, a prostitute, a da-da-da?
All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 models, arriving this summer with exclusive Scion 10 features. You can learn more and download Scion's 10-year anniversary music release at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, we'll hear an indie rock redemption story.
We actually had basically broken up. Dan was going through his descent, and I think it was about 17 months that I didn't speak to him.
The members of the folk rock revival band Hem thought they'd never write another song together, until somehow they did.
The beauty at the end of that is that as any family that goes through a really hard time, we were stronger than ever.
The reunited Hem will play some songs from their new album Departure and Farewell a bit later, but all through the show you'll hear their instrumental music. They're our house band this week. But first, how do you listen to music? I'll bet it at least partly involves online streaming on Pandora or YouTube or Spotify or some other newfangled outlet. Google just added a service and iTunes Radio is coming this fall. Musicians get paid for these streams, but they get paid a pittance. I mean, like a shocking pittance. David Lowry is the singer-songwriter for multiple bands, including Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker. You might recall Cracker's big 1993 hit, Low.
Sometimes I want to take you down. Sometimes I want to get you low.
This week on the blog Tricordist, where Lowry regularly writes about royalty issues, he got very transparent. He posted some really startling statistics about what he earns from Lowe's online streaming. The title of the post pretty much says it all. My song got played on Pandora 1 million times, and all I got was $16.89, less than what I make from a single T-shirt sale. David Lowry joins me now. David, welcome to Studio 360, and at least congratulations on how lucrative those T-shirts are.
Yeah. It's actually less than a T-shirt sale, generally.
Exactly. So you really have wonkily analyzed these royalty issues for a while. So 1 million streams on Pandora equals $16.89. What tiny fraction of a cent per listen is that?
I'm only the 40% songwriter on that, but
right.
All three songwriters together,
right.
We received 0.00364 cents. Okay.
Yeah.
Cents, not dollars.
If that's what you get for a giant hit, one thinks about all the people who haven't had the opportunity to sell that many records. And so all of these services, Spotify, Pandora, basically the same rates have been sort of not agreed upon, but essentially imposed. I mean, is there any variance? Nobody has gotten generous and say, hey, musicians and songwriters, we'll pay you a lot more than these other guys.
The rates vary according to how interactive the service is. Spotify, which is completely on demand, it's like, you know, you type in Cracker Low and you get that song played, right?
Yep.
They pay a higher royalty.
Uh-huh.
For instance, I can tell you that Spotify pays the songwriter 0.00257. So there's three leading zeros instead of four leading zeros when it comes to Spotify,
right.
Okay?
Yeah, 10 times as much.
Yes, 10 times as much.
So given that streaming is increasingly the status quo, how come we don't hear more musicians and songwriters coming out and making a stink about this?
Well, I think actually they are. Maybe it's just on the music blogs. It hasn't really hit the mainstream press, but a lot of people have been talking about their royalties, how much they got paid for a song. We really don't make as much money as people think, but there's a perception that we do. So a lot of artists tend not to want to talk about money. They talk about it privately like crazy.
Right. And I presume, given that a decade ago or whenever it was, Metallica got so burned at the early part of this, that is a cautionary tale as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. The digital world, they basically cut off Lars's head and put it on a stake outside yeah. of the city gates and said, this is what will happen to you if you complain.
Well, and I think that was then when information wanted to be free and everything was new and la-di-da-di-da. I think there is more understanding that this is not sustainable for lots and lots of working hardscrabble musicians. But, you know, the internet sort of utopians have argued from the beginning that the more people that hear your music, the better. And then musicians can monetize that fan base in other ways. Does that wash?
No, because I am specifically here talking about what songwriters get paid. Do you know the people that wrote Adele's hit songs? These guys and gals are not on the road. They're not selling t-shirts. Right. Nobody knows their names. However, there is the nuclear option for songwriters. We could withdraw from all digital services.
Right.
Then I have no idea what Pandora would play. I mean, maybe they hire a bunch of songwriters then. You think that's going to be less expensive than paying a fair royalty?
This gives a new meaning to Pandora's box.
Yes.
And I suppose they would argue, but we'll keep this service inexpensive and free in some cases, and therefore so many people will be listening that we'll all make out in the end.
What will we make out in the end? Pandora will make out in the end. I mean, how is a songwriter supposed to? I mean, we are heading towards a streaming model in music.
Right.
If we don't get this right, especially for songwriters, you'll never make any money off of songwriting. And then let's do that with books. Let's do that with films.
Right.
Let's do that with all intellectual property.
Yep.
We're the idea country. We're the country that has become so successful largely because we have ideas that we can monetize. We have intellectual property that we can monetize. This is the beginnings of undermining the entire American economy.
David Lowery, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Sure, no problem.
David Lowery sings and writes songs for Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven. So, what do you all think? Should songwriters and musicians be making more from online streaming? Would you be willing to pay some more for your Spotify and Pandora services to give songwriters and musicians a fairer shake? Leave us a comment at studio360.org. Hollywood comedies these days typically come in two types, the ones made for the boys and the ones, the romantic ones, made for the girls. The boys get The Hangover, and the girls get He's Just Not That Into You, which is why Bridesmaids was so refreshing in 2011. It let the girls have all the fun and get all the laughs.
Jesus, Megan. I'm sorry, I want to apologize. I'm not even confident of which end that came out of.
And it was huge, selling $300 million worth of tickets around the world. So for the last 2 years, movie studios have been in a kind of frenzy to make more raucous, grown-up comedies about women. Paul Feig directed Bridesmaids, and now he's out with The Heat. It's a buddy cop comedy starring Sandra Bullock as an uptight FBI agent and Melissa McCarthy as an unruly local detective. The screenplay is by Katie Dippel, whose day job is writing for Parks and Recreation. Here's a scene from The Heat where Bullock and McCarthy's characters are strategizing before they go in to interrogate a suspect.
How long is this going to take?
I don't know. Maybe 12 hours, hopefully less. I have to find out what drives him.
Or we could just go in there and beat him with a phone book.
No. For so many reasons, no. Okay, you just need to be patient, all right? It is crucial that you remain patient.
It's also crucial that you stop wearing this stupid barrette.
What is the problem with this? I mean, you have one on your head.
Yeah, on top of my head like a normal person.
What is the difference?
Just move on.
Director Paul Feig and screenwriter Katie Dippold join me now. Paul and Katie, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt.
Hi.
So I guess the buddy cop comedy genre was maybe invented on television with I Spy when I was a kid. And then in the 1980s with Beverly Hills Cop and 48 Hours, the movie genre was established. But this is the first buddy cop movie I know about where it's two female cops. Paul, have you been wanting to make that movie for a while?
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, it was just I over the years, ever since I did Freaks and Geeks, was trying to get projects off the ground that had female lead characters. And you would just immediately kind of be shut down, not even like a scolding way, just like, well, no, we can't do that because here's business reason why we can't do that. And after—
Can you make her a man?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. I mean, actually, I finally got tired of saying like, okay, and going like, well, wait, I know all these really funny women, and there's these funny women who I really like, and I'm seeing showing up in movies, and they're not being funny. Not to call out any names, but, you know, I love Rachel Harris, and I love the movie The Hangover, but, I mean, that was the most shrewish portrayal of a woman I've ever seen, and Rachel is really funny. And then same like Sarah Silverman in another great movie, School of Rock, I'm like, oh, good, here comes Sarah, she's going to be hilarious, and no, she's just being a mean girlfriend, and it's such like a little boy's view of how women are, like, oh, they ruin the good time, and mom shows up and makes
no
you stop.
No girls in the clubhouse.
Yeah, exactly. No girls allowed. So we're tearing that sign down.
Yes. I also think Bridesmaids helped a lot because before, when you would talk about ideas you had, you know, to star females, the thing you would hear back was, well, let's wait and see how Bridesmaids does, which is also crazy to me that if Bridesmaids had not done well, that people would have been like, well, we tried. You know, that's it.
Sorry, ladies. Nothing ever again.
Yeah. No doubt they would have done exactly that, right?
Women on a poster is like poison to men because they go, oh, it's going to be one of those movies. And so I'd just like to get that out of the way. So when you see two women and you go like, oh, they're funny, you just go see it because, you know, it'll be funny.
Katie, before you became a TV writer, you performed improv and you had been a professional writer for a decade. This, however, is your first feature. Was your first feature script?
Just the first one to be made.
Had you always wanted to write a cop comedy? How did this happen?
Yeah, well, I mean, I always loved buddy cop movies, and I just doing the action stuff was a stretch for my brain. I now have so much respect when I see like a great action sequence.
And it seems like an implausible, impossible part of your backstory that you actually applied to be an FBI agent?
Yes, I did. I was always obsessed with it, and I love Silence of the Lambs. And I applied after college.
You can play that, sort of.
Thank you.
Young Jodie Foster.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. See?
Everyone's going to picture just young Jodie Foster sitting here listening to this.
Yeah.
But I applied, and it was an online application, and there was no room to sort of stretch and make yourself sound awesome, like in a cover letter. And the first question was, do you have any full-time work experience? And I wrote, no, just part-time. The next one was, are you fluent in any language? And I was a Spanish minor, but not fluent, so I had to write no. And then the next question was, have you done any drug 5 times or more? And I was like, yes. And then I hit next, and it was just, thank you for submitting to the FBI. And that was it.
And you were in.
So, I'm working for them.
Say you smoked pot 6 times. That's an automatic disqualifier for being a special agent of the FBI?
I think that they've stretched it a little more.
Now they say
time.
24 times?
What? Yeah.
It's the admitting that you've done it is what gets you kicked out.
Well, you have to because they still do the lie detectors and everything, so you're getting caught. I think that the fact that I had done these drugs, but there was also nothing else I could offer them, was the issue.
That's right.
Your day job has been, as I said, writing for Parks and Recreation. That's a very different kind of writing that doesn't jibe with anything I know as writing. It was adapting to the sitting in a room and typing alone great? A new thing?
It was a mixed bag. I mean, sometimes it's fun just to go off on your own and just write whatever you want, you know, and have that freedom. But then, you know, it's really nice being able to turn to a full writer's room and be like, hey, what would be funny here? You know, really miss that. It's nice. But then
An app. That's a web service you guys could start, right?
Yes, exactly. Oh, virtual writer's room.
Exactly.
That would be great.
And every time you sign it, just be people eating lunch.
Yes. And then watching YouTube videos.
You are now, Paul Feig, with this movie, which will undoubtedly be successful, the generalissimo of this emergence of the equally smart, equally funny female comedy. Does it ever strike you as ironic, odd, uncomfortable that you're a man doing being this generalissimo?
Well, I mean, I love it because I love funny women and always have. But it is a little odd that it's such a shortage of these movies that it falls to me, a 50-year-old man, to suddenly be the one. You know, and I'm really trying to break down the walls, but I don't want to be the walls I'm breaking down is so that I can just do them all because I can't do that many. And there's so many funny women who should be in these things and writing them and directing them. But women are half the population of the world. And this, we are, our ratios are way off right
More
now.
Than half the population.
Well, there you go, see? And yet, this summer, of studio releases, we are the only movie this summer to star women.
Really?
Yep, the only one. I mean, there's a couple of indies coming out, like Bling Ring and A To-Do List, but otherwise, no, that's it, nothing.
Do you feel, oh my gosh, Bridesmaid changed what Katie could aspire to write and sell. This has to be good too, or they'll say, oh, that was a fluke and a one-off?
Yeah, I do feel that weirdly because, again, since we're the only one, if we underperform, they'll go, well, see, you can't open a movie with women in the summer. And
yeah.
Then you're going to just keep getting all these guy movies. It's so very self-serving, but, you know, the only thing Hollywood listens to is box office. So please go see The Heat.
you, Paul, have directed, in addition to Bridesmaids and other features, lots and lots of television episodes in the last 10 years of some of the most beloved shows like The Office and 30 Rock and Mad Men and Arrested Development. Do you ever have a hankering to say, I've got this idea for a TV show. I'm going to go do that for the next 5 years.
Well, I love TV. I mean, TV is in such a great place these days. It's way better than movies, to be honest.
It is the golden age, as we know.
But no, I never want to walk away from television. I would like to keep my hand in both.
And you, Katie, now that you're a big-time Hollywood writer and have sold your next script and blah, 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 are you just like looking down on your Parks and Rec colleagues and going to walk away soon?
Oh, absolutely. No, good. Of course not. Good. No. Not at all, no.
Okay, I think we're done here. But you want to keep doing that?
Yeah. I mean, I had to take a leave from it, but I do miss it.
But she is writing two more scripts for me, so.
Is that right,
she's
too?
Not going back anytime soon. Sorry, Mike Scherer.
So you're going to keep making movies together?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
If she will have me.
Absolutely.
Does it feel like, I mean, certainly with Bridesmaids and now, assuming The Heat is a gigantic box office success.
Please.
The conversation of women aren't funny, are women as funny, we're at the beginning of the end of that, presumably.
Yeah, whenever that debate comes back up online, I'm like, this is crazy. Like,
yeah.
It's crazy.
But it's kind of like gay marriage, you know? You go like, okay, eventually the old guard will die out and nobody will think about this anymore.
Well, it was a pleasure meeting and talking to you both.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Katie Dippold wrote and Paul Feig directed The Heat, which opens everywhere in America this weekend. Coming up next, one of the big 80s art stars comes clean about the motivations of ambitious artists.
I know an awful lot of artists, and no one convinces me they're not competitive. It's a thin veneer of cool on top of a raging, but it's something that doesn't get talked about, so it seemed time to just say, look, you know, let's face it.
The painter Eric Fischel has written a memoir that is surprisingly honest about himself, the art world, his peers, and rivals. We'll talk about it next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Notes for Notes, a nonprofit program in Nashville providing music education to kids. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Since Saturday Night Live's Deep Thoughts, Jack Handy has been the king of a certain kind of short-take deadpan absurdity in The New Yorker and elsewhere. But now he is a novelist. His new book is called The Stench of Honolulu, and Studio 360 is bringing you a few exclusive bits from it in luscious stereophonic sound. Previously on The Stench of Honolulu.
Scariest of all was the hideous old crone. She pointed her long, crooked finger at Don and me and croaked,
Do not go on this trip. There is nothing but death and destruction.
Then she said, but if you do go, I can get you a really good deal. All we had to do was connect through St. Louis.
And now, episode 2.
The world looks different after you've narrowly avoided joining the Hawaiian army. Colors seem brighter. Every breath seems like a gift. And every cigarette, a treasure. There was a spring in my step. So much so that people told me to stop doing it. My mind was expanding. Or maybe my brain was expanding. Something was expanding. The sunshine seemed warmer, the breeze cooler, and my pants seemed to fit better. I felt generosity toward all mankind. I gave my stapler to a leper. I noticed things I had never noticed before, like the dew on the spider web and the blood on the giant spider web. I was aware for the first time of all the meth pipes in the skunkweed and all the used condoms on the sidewalk. Feeling better, said Don. I put up my hand for him to hold that thought as I was busy noticing things. I overslept the next morning. I crammed some clothes and packs of cigarettes around the scotch bottles to prevent breakage and started waddling as fast as I could to the wharf. Don was on the boat, motioning for me to come on, then motioning at his watch. Don's always motioning about something. We headed upriver into the vast, untamed vastness of Hawaii. Gradually, the smell of Honolulu faded and was replaced by the smell of the crew. At last, we were on our way. We hadn't gone far when something happened that I took as an ill omen. We were attacked by a huge swarm of bats. The bats flapped about our heads, scratching and biting us without mercy. They were like a tornado, only not a regular tornado, a tornado of bats. We tried to slap them away, but they were relentless. What were bats doing out in the daytime? That's when I noticed the solar eclipse, which didn't seem like a good sign either. When the sun finally came back, the bats went away. But then we were attacked by pelicans.
That's Jack Handy reading from his new novel, The Stench of Honolulu. If you missed the first part, you can listen at studio360.org, and we'll have two more excerpts in the coming weeks. Last summer, we embarked on a project to redesign Canada, among other things, to create new branding for our northern neighbors, who Americans have a tendency to consider, well, to not consider at all. So we teamed up with the Toronto-based design firm Bruce Mao to change that a little and launched a campaign called No Canada that highlights cool things about the country of which you probably weren't aware. This year, just in time for Canada Day, that's July 1st, as I now know, Bruce Mao has extended that process that we began. They've come up with a brand new No Canada iPhone app. It lets you snap a picture with two big red Canadian flag-like bars framing the subject to make an instant postcard you can share with your friends. So if you were Canadian or like Canadians or wish you were Canadian, this app is for you. Check it out at studio360.org. Thirty-five years ago, a young artist with a big attitude moved to New York City and set up in a loft downtown. All around him, people were making conceptual art, shooting video art, doing performance art. So this artist, Eric Fischel, did the most radical thing he could think of. He started to paint paintings, big, carefully rendered figure paintings, people in recognizable scenes and activities. But there was something dark and uneasy about Fischel's pictures. Like the painting called Bad Boy, which you can see in a slideshow of his work at studio360.org.
It's a scene that takes place in a bedroom in a striated light that is marking in lights and darks the figure of a naked woman who's sort of idly picking at her toes while she's exposing her private parts to a young boy, maybe 11 years old, whose back is to the viewer. And you see the boy is reached behind him and is going through her purse looking for something.
The painting Bad Boy, with this combination of old-fashioned painterly beauty and edgy subject matter, helped launch Eric Fischel's career in the 1980s. And he writes very frankly about that period in a new memoir, which is also called Bad Boy.
Yeah, I mean, I was certainly tackling several taboos at that time, some personal taboos, some social and some artistic. And the more or less traditional rendering of a scene was at that time a modernist taboo.
And had been for 60, 70 years.
Yeah, since Picasso or Braque threw it out the window. And then, of course, there's the potentially incestuous or inappropriate in some level kind of engagement between these two.
In your conception, what is he swiping or doing?
It doesn't matter what I thought. And that's the nature of the art exchange. What I try to do is make a painting that takes you to a particular place in which meaning is present, but it's based on your associations. You end up possessing the experience by you attaching meaning to it.
So I or any viewer finishes the painting?
Exactly. They look at the woman and they decide, is that the mother, a babysitter, a prostitute, a da-da-da, right? They look at the boy in the purse and they decide, is he stealing money? Is he looking for car keys? All those things are possible.
And as you say, they are characters. And because they are figurative scenes, there is this sense of narrative. I mean, did you feel when you started that what you were doing was closer to what novelists and filmmakers do than what other painters, what painters had been doing at that time?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely it took me a while to discover that I actually was a narrative painter. As long as we're talking about Bad Boy, I'll tell you that I actually started this painting only wanting to paint a bowl of fruit. I just thought, I'll paint a bowl of fruit, then see where it goes.
How traditional of you.
Yes, exactly.
So I get how this was this radical new thing that serious artists weren't supposed to do in 1980. What about the personal taboos you talked about or the personal parts of your life that was brought to bear here?
Yeah, I grew up in suburbs.
This is Long Island outside New York?
It's outside. It was a bedroom community of the city. My father worked in the city. You grow up when you have that kind of community, you grow up in this place that is mainly a sort of culture of imagery. Everybody wants their houses to look the same. They want their clothes. It's everyone's measuring things based on the look of something. So there's a veneer there. And then there's the reality of life, which is much more complicated and nuanced and stuff. And I came out of a family that had a lot of tragedy in it. My mother was a very ferocious and sad alcoholic who ultimately took her life. So,
in an automobile accident.
Yes, yeah.
And it's harrowing to read. And your life with your alcoholic mother. And we're kind of familiar with the high-functioning alcoholic moms and dads, but she was not that.
No, she was a binger and somebody really very brave at times, struggling with this disease, and at other times, just full of shame at failing to manage it. So,
well, and you write about your mother, among other in addition to having this terrible illness of alcoholism, what was naked a lot around your house.
Yeah, as was my father, yes.
But not in any kind of new age nudist way, just they just didn't wear clothes a lot?
It was something that at times, initially it seemed natural. It was like, well, that's what parents do. And then, you start finding out other parents don't do that. But there was like a culture of experimentation, of is the age of you know, key parties and stuff like that. So,
and when you were called, as you started painting these paintings, you were often called a painter of suburbia. How did that sit? I mean, you were, among other things.
I was, and I wear it proudly. I mean, it was something. It took me a while to shed the prejudice against that subject. But once I did, it's what I know, and it's fertile ground.
You and your generation, Julian Schnabel, David Solly, and others, were the first generation of artists for whom fame and money were available when you were young, and then became expected. And that's really changed what it means to aspire to be an artist, hasn't it?
Yes. I mean, now they're inextricable. Back then, I mean, it's irony of ironies, because I think we approached it, fame and fortune weren't connected. We wanted to be famous. We wanted to be a part of the historical dialogue.
You didn't care if you made a lot of money doing it.
No, and we knew a lot of people we greatly admired before us who weren't living well or were just barely getting by or were doing two jobs. We really thought that art was going to change the world and reweave the fabric of the society. And then we sat in the 80s watching the fabric weave us into it. And that was something that we didn't see coming.
That's interesting. So because the 80s were, among other things, the beginning of this era where the market rules, basically you and your fellow artists just capitulated to that new paradigm.
To some extent, there was the path of least resistance was part of it. There was certainly the fun of a lot of it. And it's a complicated experience,
yeah.
That's for sure.
I was impressed by how frank you are in this book about your sheer ambition, not just artistic ambition, but, because it's much easier to say. And the thing that all artists and writers are supposed to say is, I just care about the work. But you really cared about success.
Yeah. I mean, I know an awful lot of artists, and no one convinces me they're not competitive. It's a thin veneer of cool. On yeah. top of a raging, whatever. But it's something that doesn't get talked about. So it seemed time to just say, look, let's face it.
And once you decided, this is what I'm going to paint, I'm going to paint people in these scenes, did fellow artists or people in that world say to you, Eric, what are you doing?
I think they applauded me for doing it without thinking that they had to do it.
Yeah.
But every art movement that's avant-garde needs at least one retro-garde artist. Otherwise, you can't measure the distance that they've traveled in their avant-gardeness.
But you still have not much use for abstraction, for instance.
I love abstraction.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just not good at it.
Really? It always seemed like it would be easier to be good at that.
No, God, are you kidding? I was the kind of abstract painter that it was so not natural to me that I had to justify every time I changed the size of my brush. Like if I was painting a rectangular shape, why change the size of the brush in that rectangle?
Because there's nothing telling you to.
There's nothing telling. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Eric Fischel, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it.
Eric Fischel's new memoir is called Bad Boy, My Life on and Off the Canvas. Just ahead, this week's in-house band Hem joins me in the studio to talk and play a few songs off their beautiful new album, Departure and Farewell. That's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Wonderheads, a Portland theater company specializing in mask performances. Learn more at scion.com.
The This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. A few weeks ago, we introduced our latest extra credit listener challenge, Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands.
I used to have Rock Band back in high school.
Battle of the High School Bands.
Excellent!
We want to hear you rock.
My name is Benjamin Running. My high school band is called the Plaid Habits. We were from Williamstown, Massachusetts. And the song is called Velvet Elvis.
Velvet Elvis on the wall. Who's the coolest of them all? Now I want to wear a white jumpsuit. And I want some platform shoes. Now I want to buy some dark sunglasses. Now I want to smoke his velvet ashes.
We played a lot of shows. We were probably the most popular band in our high school. Velvet Elvis was, I would say, our biggest hit. It's a song that everybody really liked when they heard our record. That was about it. I think this is probably the farthest it's ever gone.
Two big-time rock professionals, Party King Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen of Tao and the Get Down Stay Down, are judging the contest. Whether your band sounded angry or profound or were just having a good time, we want to hear your music. The deadline is July 21st, and you can find all the details at studio360.org/myhighschoolband. Long, long ago, I'm talking 1999, three musicians in Brooklyn were looking for a lead singer to front their new band. Craigslist didn't exist in New York at the time, so Dan Massey did what people did back then. He placed a classified ad in the newspaper. Sally Ellison saw that ad, found Dan, and in perfectly analog fashion gave him a cassette tape on which she sang a lullaby.
Tuck a cloud up under my chin. Lord, blow the moon out, please.
That actual audition recording was used as the first track on the band's debut album, Rabbit Songs. The band is Hem. They've kept making lovely, critically acclaimed music for a decade and have just released their sixth studio album, Departure and Farewell. Dan Massey, Sally Ellison, and the rest of Hem. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So classified ad, tape cassettes. All we needed is like a Y2K and Monica Lewinsky reference, and we'd have a complete motif. Your songs have roots further back than 1999 in, let's say, the American folk music tradition of the first half of the 20th century. Dan, you are the main songwriter. Is early 20th century where you're coming from?
I think that's where our hearts lie, for sure. I think we all had parents who had really deep record collections.
Are there particular songwriters or performers who've influenced you the most?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love everyone from Stephen Foster and Gershwin and Copeland, the Carter family, the Rolling Stones. I mean, it all feeds into this voice that we have developed as a group.
I'm a fan of all those. And the Gershwin-Copeland things, I guess, would explain some of the string stuff on this album.
I love those strings. That Copeland, those big, wide-open spaces that he's able to conjure up with those orchestrations are a huge influence. And the idea was to wed that to folk songs and to pop songs and to see what it conjured up in that world.
And Sally, this music from the beginning, which has this sort of lullaby quality of sweetness and melancholy and these beautiful melodies, seems like a perfect match. Was there a eureka moment when you guys met and said, I'm perfect for this music?
You know, I do think that there was. I think I would have sung probably anything just to try something out. But when I heard Dan's music and his songs, I was so incredibly moved. I thought, this is exactly what I would want to be singing. And it's truly my favorite thing about being in the band is that I get to sing these songs first.
Before we talk some more, can we hear a song so people know what we're talking about?
Sure.
What will this be?
We're going to sing Tourniquet, or play Tourniquet.
Two, three, four.
Green point pins down my hand, red hook pierces my heart, and my blood runs into the Gowanus Canal, where it sinks to the bottom. It hurts like hell. The prospectors still search for hides in the heights till their first bloody nose, which they laugh off despite how it seems that whatever gets left in a bar just becomes part of Brooklyn. Here we are. Oh, here we are. Here we are. Oh, here we are. Brooklyn, your war was just won by the South. Some kid shooting off rounds from the roof of his mouth. And these trains held in chambers are ready to blow all the way. Traffic comes to a standstill. We come to a standstill. I come to a standstill.
That was Tourniquet, performed live here in our studio by Hem, with Dan Massey on piano, Stephen Curtis on guitar and vocals, Gary Maurer on guitar as well, George Rush on bass, Dawn Landis on vocals and Glockenspiel, and Sally Allison on lead vocals. It's a song that makes me want to produce a movie or create a TV show of which that would be the theme.
Please do.
Okay, thank you. And before we say anything else about the song, I need to tell our non-Brooklyn listeners that although the Gowanus Canal makes for a lovely lyric, the actual canal, which is five blocks from where I live, is a filthy black backwater and a federal Superfund site. But it sounds romantic in the song.
Don't go there if you're a dolphin, for sure.
Does the Gowanus Canal, which is a lovely, romantic, but kind of ruined and polluted thing, serve as a metaphor for ruined pastoral?
The Gowanus Canal is a perfect example of what my world had become at that point, which was this ideal, beautiful, romantic place that had been sort of poisoned. When I wrote that song, I was in a really dark place. And Brooklyn, which is a place that I really love and has been my home for many years, just seemed really dangerous and toxic.
And Sally, when he was having in that dark place, was that precarious time for the band?
We actually had basically broken up. Dan was going through his descent, and there was a point where none of us were speaking to Dan in particular, and I think it was about 17 months that I didn't speak to him. It was probably the hardest time that we would have ever even imagined going through, because we are so not that kind of a band. We are absolutely a family. And the beauty at the end of that is that Dan came back to the land of the living. And we came back, and as any family that goes through a really hard time, we're as stronger than ever. Which
like
is
the
really
Rolling
nice.
Stones. they put up with Keith, and there he still is.
It's so funny to think of myself in the same.
It's so.
We're
not that cool. We really no. are not.
Can we hear another song?
This song is called Walking Past the Graveyard and Not Breathing.
With iron wings, we are there though we can see them, and the breath inside is burning. Though the games we play as children came to harden into bone, hiding from this city made of stone. I'm walking past the grave. The breath inside me stay as I stumble out the barroom, or I'm face down in the hallway where the games we played as children keep us safe.
That was Hem performing Walking Past the Graveyard, Not Breathing from their terrific new album, Departure and Farewell. Thank you so much for coming in here today.
Thank you, Kurt.
Hem's new album, Departure and Farewell, is out right now. And you listeners can watch a video of Hem's performance here in Studio 360 at studio360.org. I also want to thank you for being kind of our house band for this episode of Studio 360. How about one more song to take us out?
You got it.
And this will be what?
This will be the perfect ending to the perfect show. It's called So Long.
So long.
To part.
is it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you all very much for listening. And don't forget to send us the best music you made in high school. All the details for Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands are at studio360.org/myhighschoolband. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferum,
Alana Harper,
Anne Hepperman,
Eric Malinsky,
Chloe Plant,
Rachel Lewis Krisky,
Ellen Mayer,
Mark Sheely.
Thanks also to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiga. And if you miss us between shows, you can pay us a visit on Twitter at Studio360Show and at KB Anderson. That's Anderson, S-E-N.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Lilco, a letterpress and design studio in Dallas. Learn more at scion.com. Studio 360 is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the Civil War battle that's still going on.
I wish I...
People now are denied the use of the song because the politically correct say that it's offensive.
The never-ending fight over the song Dixie.
Look away.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Look away.